You're listening to The Dead Prussian, a podcast about war and warfare.
We've talked about how fiction can help us understand war. In fact, the most recent episode was all about fiction intelligence. We've also talked about future capabilities, but we haven't really talked about what if that fiction was out of this world? What if it was science fiction? What if it was events that happened a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away? G'day, listeners, and welcome to the Dead Prussian Podcast. I'm your host, Mick, and I am back with another interesting episode. As you've noticed this year, we have focused on a couple of themes. A lot of them have to do with the future of war, either the way tech is going, the way people are thinking about war in the future, or how we can start to prognosticate about how war might look in the future. Today we're going into the deep, deep, deep past, the 70s, to explore the future, and also to try and understand modern conflict as it stands today. Now, to do this, I've had to assemble a team. Not quite like the Avengers, a little bit more like the Justice League, because I'm a dark kind of guy. But what we're going to explore today is Star Wars, and how Star Wars can inform modern conflict. There's recently been a book with some excellent authors, some writing on such wonderful topics as collateral damage and just war theory, and these writers are using Star Wars to try and understand conflict today and also how conflict in the future can be informed through pop culture. Now, my guests today are, in no particular order except that one that is alphabetical, John Amble. He is the editorial director of Modern War Institute, a military intelligence officer in the US Army Reserve, and a veteran of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. My next guest, you all should know, from one of our very early episodes. In fact, I think our first episode on using pop culture to explore war, and that is Max Brooks. He's a writer, public speaker, non-resident fellow at the Modern War Institute at West Point, and senior resident fellow at the Atlantic Council's Art of Future War project, a project you all, my listeners, should be aware of. He is the author of World War Z, An Oral History of the Zombie War, excellent book, and The Harlem Hellfighters, another excellent book, among other works. M.L. Kavanagh, I like using his initials, is a non-resident fellow at the Modern War Institute and a US Army strategist with global experience and assignments ranging from the Pentagon to Korea and Iraq to Army and Space and Missile Defense Command. His writing has appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, and USA Today, among other publications. And I'm going to call him Matt. And last but certainly not least, someone here to add a little bit of class to the rest of us, it is Jane Gates. She's a science fiction editor and author with more than a dozen anthologies to her credit, and she is the co-editor of War Stories, New Military Science Fiction. Lady and gents, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having us.
It's great to be here.
And what I like about that is all the gents were very chivalrous and waited for the lady to answer first, which is good. Keep it up and we'll have a good show. Now, my first question will go to you, Matt, because before we delve into the world of Star Wars, the actual project, which resulted in the book Strategy Strikes Back, was your idea and a pet project of sorts. So I guess my first question for this episode on this topic must be, how did you develop the idea to take George Lucas's classic sci-fi series and mashing it together with some strategic theory? Where did that come from?
Yeah, thanks for the question, Mick. And you should know, first of all, that I'm on a family vacation on a lake in northern Minnesota in the United States. And the only phone call I would take on this vacation is from an Australian named Mick or a dead Prussian. Mm-hmm. And I hit two for two. You know, the project was it was and is a labor of love. You know, to me, the first film, it was titled A New Hope, and this book is a new lens. It's a new way of talking about modern conflict and military strategy. Too often, I think we've been bogged down in history and theory, and there's nothing wrong with history or both are useful and important, but there's more that we can get out of strategy and conflict from the screen. And it really starts with having taught at West Point. When I was there teaching at West Point, I was having conversations on conflict and strategy with cadets who are a full generation distant from me. And it was hard for us to have conversations because we weren't locked and loaded with a similar set of experiences. So there was a generational boundary. And from there, I went to Korea, where I worked on a staff that was half Korean Army officers. So half of the conversations I had about conflict and strategy were with a group of people that had a very different set of experiences. So there was a cultural gap. And the great thing about Star Wars is that whether you're a cadet, a Korean, a colonel, or a civilian, Star Wars is the one war we all know something about. It crosses languages and cultures and generations. I've gotten a little bit of flack for this. I really actually believe that this is the Peloponnesian War for the modern world in many ways, not all, but in many ways. And it's useful not just for folks with short haircuts. It's useful to have conversations with civilians because this is a war that the civilian public really, really knows. And it's estimated that the United States government by 2050 will have spent $5.6 trillion on the war, the post 9/11 wars. We all have skin in these games. Mm-hmm. You know, we're involved in several conflicts right now at once. Armies alone don't fight wars; societies wage wars. So it's very useful to use Star Wars as sort of a gateway drug to important strategic concepts. To some extent, this book is a little bit of pot that I hope that brings people to the strategic heroin, you know, so that they find a way into subjects that I think are really critical. And it's not hyperbole or an exaggeration for me to say that my life as a military officer and the outcomes of our wars depend on wise citizen choices. So that's why, I mean, for a lot of reasons, we thought that fiction provided a vehicle. And so it's, you know, the idea started with Star Wars, but at first I was a little bit wobbly on the concept. And I thought maybe we ought to include a wide variety of fiction. So you could use many films. You know, some people talk about Starship Troopers, whatever it might be. And so I pitched the idea to Max Brooks, who's on the line as well, and then another fellow with the Modern War Institute, August Cole, and said, what do you guys think about this idea? And Max was very full-throated in saying, look, if you're too wide with the idea, then it's going to dissipate. Let's just fix our ideas to one particular pop culture, you know, the mountain. You know, let's go to the peak of the mountain first, which is Star Wars. And so when we sort of said the book would be about Star Wars, and the second decision was how would you execute that idea, we decided that it would be fun to include writers from all walks of war. Generals like Stanley McChrystal, Admiral James DeRitas, the former Supreme Allied Commander of Europe, but also ground-level military officers from the Air Force, Army, Navy, and the Marine Corps, but also some diplomats and some journalists as well. to leverage hundreds of years of strategic experience to bring to bear on this subject. But that quickly got very daunting. And that's why I begged the best two editors on conflict and science fiction that I could possibly find, which are, you know, John Amble and James Gates. So who I'm thrilled to say are also on the team as well.
It's good that you've thrown to Max, because my next question actually goes to Max. But I like the point of Star Wars being a bridge between cultures. And, you know, it's actually been accused in the past of cultural appropriation. So I guess it's appropriate that it's used as a bridge between some of those cultures. And it's also worth noting that you mentioned, like, the span of writers. You really have brought together a, I'm not going to say a motley crew, because most of them are actually quite well-groomed. But, well, I'll say it anyway, a motley crew of writers, most of them, not all of them.
This is the bar. This is the Mos Eisley cantina of writers.
Now, my next question goes to you, Max. You're known for using fiction, film, comics, graphic novels, art, just pop culture in general, to get people to ask important questions about war. One of our recent guests also mentioned how you've likened some white papers and other policy documents to sedatives. So I guess my question is, you know, why is art particularly useful medium to explore modern conflict?
I think that fiction is so important nowadays, because at this point, nothing is off the table. And we need to learn that, because our enemies understand that very clearly. I think from Desert Storm on, the rest of the world understood that the American military had perfected a system of systems, a way of fighting. And therefore, they're not even trying to compete anymore. The Chinese have learned from the Soviets. The Russians have learned from the Soviets. And so our enemies have a massive intellectual, nimble, innovative leap over us. You know, we talked in the 60s about a missile gap. There's an innovation gap. And our enemies are trying everything. And nothing is off the table for them. And therefore, we need to get back to that. We need to compete on an intellectual agility level. And fiction is a great way to do it, because it's a way to explore difficult concepts that reach out, as Matt said, to the regular folks who are, let's face it, the voters. You know, if we lived in a place which had a ruling class, which could say, listen, you peasants, you go and till your fields, we got this, that would be different. But as long as we leave out the population, they're going to make bad choices at the ballots, and they're going to elect leaders who have no idea what they're talking about, and those leaders are going to send our military out to get killed. And therefore, we need to get back to a language that the voters speak. That's why it's so important to use any method we can, fiction, comic books, movies. And we used to be excellent at that. In World War II, we had an entire army of doing nothing but reaching out to the voters and explaining what's going on. And we were pretty good at that during the Cold War. And somehow in the 90s, we kind of just lost it all. And we need to get it back, because the people who don't like us and want a very different worldview are leaps and bounds ahead of us when it comes to innovation.
It's interesting to draw on World War II. And for my listeners that don't know, Max is well-versed in what is a big love of mine, comics and graphic novels. Things like Captain America. Go back and look at Captain America and why he was created in World War II. And I don't mean like go back and watch the movie and see why he was created in a lab somewhere. I mean go back and look at the comic book history. But it's a great point you make, Max, about for those of us who live in liberal democracies. And, you know, I'm not saying I don't have listeners in authoritarian regimes. Hi, guys. But for those of us who live in liberal democracies, the conversation is extremely important. So I think it's quite impressive that as a team of editors, y'all, there's my American language coming across there, have gotten together to find a medium that appeals to a broader section of those people. So I guess my next question comes to someone who's not in the military or a member of a military think tank. So someone actually on that other side of the fence. And that's for yourself, Jane. War and science fiction's kind of your bread and butter. You edit a work on this. You've written on this. So I guess, are you able to explain to the listeners why you believe science fiction as a specific genre is a useful medium to explore war?
Absolutely, thank you. So I think something that gives a little bit of basis for why I got into this and why I believe so much in the intersection of science fiction and strategic thinking is I come from a military family. My cousin's actually a writer for a number of military sites. He has been one of the people who kind of inspired me to go into some of this. Discussions with him were one of the things that spawned the War Stories anthology that I did. I also, when I was, when I was in my early 20s, a number of my good friends were just coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. And so it was one of those things where, you know, we'd go out for beers and we'd be listening to them talk and tell stories. And one of the things that really came across, because they knew I worked in science fiction, was that none of the science fiction was really modern. Most of it was the World Wars or Vietnam. And so they were feeling really isolated and kind of cut out of this thing that they wanted to identify with, but that didn't call back to them. And so that was what spawned War Stories. In turn, War Stories actually spawned my year working with a group called the Syria Airlift Project, which was working on bringing relief to the cities of Syria that were under siege. Unfortunately, that project ended up tanking because we, right at the time that we were getting ready to deploy some of our humanitarian efforts was when Russia got involved and the political situation blew up so badly that there was no way that we could manage anything, especially because the leader of the project was active duty Air Force and could not put himself into that situation. But during that year, I was working with a number of brilliant engineers, many of whom were refugees from Syria. And one of the things that we would talk about in our Skype calls was science fiction. And one of the stories in War Stories was from the leader of this project, who used science fiction to talk about what ultimate pacification of the Middle East could look like and how horrifying that could be. And so all of these things kind of got together and really started me thinking in a much more critical way about science fiction in the military. And I think that one of the most useful things, and this goes back to what Matt has been talking about, is that science fiction gives you a narrative framework to understand things. It gives you something that you can lean on in a bad time. Like the heroic narrative is not a thing to explain to someone because it's so integral to all of our media. So you talk about Captain America. Well, if you're in a stressful situation, you're wanting to give up, you're wanting to fall back into the easy route, you look at Captain America, it's like, okay, this guy, this scrawny kid from Brooklyn, if he can do it, I can do it too. Serum aside, this kid had the heart to do it. I can do it too. And so you have something that you can lean on, that you can look for, and it gives you a sense of safety. And we see that a lot in civilians too, where, you know, you're facing a stressful, terrifying thing. And sometimes that little bit of extra courage from a comic book hero can give you a little bit more. But that means that it crosses the divide between civilians and military, and it gives a common language. One of the things that I've worked on quite a lot is bridging the gap between science and engineering and civilians. I grew up in a engineering family. And so having all of that that ability to interpret the engineer's speech really helped me out later on. So I think that's a lot of where I came into it from.
And what's really fascinating about that, I find, is the the fiction brought together a concept for a humanitarian project. Thanks, Russia, for getting in the way. But it's an important example, I think, for listeners to try and understand where these projects can go. And the idea is kind of your experiences kind of explain that concept that Max was talking about in terms of getting people involved in understanding war and its consequences. And I love that you used Captain America in your explanation there. But ladies and gents, we didn't even plan that. It's just worked out brilliantly. So for anyone out there who wants to give me a late night TV show, these questions can work. Though Australians don't really watch late night talk shows, so I probably have to move to America. And James Corden's already got the funny foreigner market tied up. So let's take James' point further with you, John, sitting there quietly as an editorial director does. Now, you're an editorial director at a think tank, at one of the most prestigious training academies in the world. So I expect most of my listeners would believe that West Point deals in cold, hard history, military theory, rather than Millennium Falcons and lightsabers. So I guess the question kind of stands out. How do books such as Strategy Strikes Back and tying them to pop culture and strategic theory, how are they used to educate the next generation of military leaders, particularly because they're all growing up on the latest trilogy? But that's an aside.
You're not wrong. West Point does have the reputation, and it's probably a well-deserved reputation, of being sort of a conservative, slow-moving institution. You can book. There was quite a good book that came out a few years ago called West Point 1915, the Class the Stars Fell On, because there was this graduating class in 1915 that went on to become the general officers. Like, one third of the class wore general officer stars during World War II, and it talked about the training that they got in 1915. And it was, still horse-mounted cavalry and all kinds of things that by the time they become operational and strategic leaders in the Army is almost laughably outdated. And I think that West Point, the Army as a whole, but West Point has that sort of reputation. But I think that's changing, not only at West Point, but across the U.S. Army and Department of Defense as a whole. And so I think, that leads into this idea that I think one of the biggest things that underpins this project, Strategy Strikes Back, is a recognition that the world is becoming more complex and war is becoming more complex along with it. And yes, sure, that claim that everything is getting more complex, it sounds like a platitude. And in some ways it can be when it's put out there. But it's not actually that difficult to kind of break it down and see it. If you look at, there's a really good article written, I think probably about 3 years ago now, by a guy named Paul Shari, who's got a great new book on autonomy out. But this article kind of traced the history of warfare from an early stage of what he called melee, which is essentially you could have groups of 100 people on either side, but it ended up being one-on-one fights. There was no order to it. Mm. Onto mass, where the sum is greater than, or the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. So you would have mass formations that would fight together as a unit that then evolved into maneuver, where you would have one of these mass elements sort of fix an adversary in place while the other one maneuvers and flanks it, which is sort of maneuver warfare is really where we've been for, centuries now. And then kind of project forward to look at what's next. And he hypothesized that what's next is swarm. And if you look at that, from melee to mass to maneuver to swarm, swarm warfare is necessarily and obviously more complex than any of those that have come before. Mm-hmm. You take another example, U.S. defense planners are looking now at how we'll operate on the future battlefield, and the concept that the Army at least has devised is something they call multi-domain battle. And it's tough enough to maintain awareness and to operate effectively in your own domain. If you're in the Army, to do so on land, if you're in the Navy, to do so at sea. Now you need to not only maintain awareness, but be able to affect operations in other domains. That also means that the warfare is becoming more complex. You also look at, you know, increased technology, increased role of computers, the introduction of artificial intelligence, machine learning. All of these mean the pace of war is increasing. So I don't think it's a I think that it's easy to sort of write off this notion that warfare is becoming more complex as a platitude, but it's not hard to see that it is. So for all of those reasons, the everyday tasks of members of the profession of arms pose greater and greater challenges. So why then would we turn our back on a tool that kind of helps us to understand that? And that's what I think Star Wars is. You know, it's come up a couple times in this conversation that many members of the team, that both editorial team and the roster of incredible authors, I can't say enough about the authors, have connections to West Point through the Modern War Institute where I work. In addition to working here, I teach in the Defense and Strategic Studies program here at West Point. I most recently taught insurgency and counterinsurgency. And I got to give you some context for listeners that aren't familiar. West Point is a very unique place. It's not like I didn't go here. I commissioned through Officer Candidate School. It's not like where I went to college, where most people went to college at civilian colleges or universities. Cadets cannot miss class. They certainly can't fall asleep in class, which is maybe something a little bit foreign to some of us who went to civilian universities. But that doesn't mean that they show up every day, you know, in top form, ready to learn, which means that when you're trying to teach them, you really need to engage them, engage with them. And there were days in class when that was somewhat difficult. The book came out toward the end of this last semester, with a few weeks left in the semester. And I had a few cadets who found it and immediately wanted to talk about it. And so I had them read one of the chapters, which is the chapter on counterinsurgency written by Colonel Liam Collins. It's a fascinating chapter. It essentially imagines a war council in which an imperial military staff is debating whether or not to use the Death Star. And there are some junior officers, you know, manufactured characters in this scenario who suggest, no, we need a more effective counterinsurgency strategy rather than just, you know, wiping out this planet. The chapter is, you know, it's a page turning chapter because it's all in dialogue form. It's fascinating. It's interesting. But it also it introduces insurgency and counterinsurgency theory. It reflects what we've learned from the history of insurgency and counterinsurgency. But it does so in this really engaging way. And it was so obvious that it was working when I was talking to these cadets. And I guess just to kind of wrap up, I'd point to one other thing that sort of demonstrates the effectiveness. Matt mentioned that one of the chapters was co-written by Admiral James Stavridis, who is the former commander of U.S. European Command and of NATO. His chapter was about hybrid warfare. Now, there is a ton of debate about what that actually means, what hybrid warfare actually means, and whether or not it's really a thing, or if it's just political warfare, if it's just sort of, you know, a new name for something that's always been around. But it, you know, broadly speaking, it essentially refers to what Russia is doing in places like the Donbass in eastern Ukraine, what they did in Crimea from 2014 onward. I actually just got back from Ukraine a couple days ago. And as a form of conflict, whether or not it exists, whether or not this is the right term for it, I'm a big believer that it is a really hard sort of form of conflict to kind of frame and conceptualize, which makes it exceedingly difficult to deal with from the strategic all the way down to the tactical levels. At the strategic level, it's how do we form policy responses to this type of conflict? Down to the tactical level, it's, you know, how should the way we train evolve in response? How should our TTPs, our tactics, techniques, and procedures change? These are big, difficult questions. I'm a big believer that given these massive challenges, we would be absolute fools not to take advantage of any tool that can help us navigate them. And I think that the world of fiction and Star Wars in particular is a really powerful one of those tools.
Now, speaking as someone who did attend a military university, had to wear uniform and was not allowed to fall asleep in class and got reprimanded for such actions, I really wish this book had been on the curriculum back then. But that we would have barely been through the second trilogy by the time I was there. In fact, I think I watched the last two films in the middle trilogy, I'm going to call it, which are the prequels, whilst I was studying. But I did do a subject called Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, so it wasn't all bad. Now, my second to last question, and that's right, listeners, I've stopped saying penultimate because there's been too many complaints from tankers, which US term, or tankies, Australian term, and just cavalry or armoured corps officers for the British. So I'm just going to say my second to last question from now on, and I'll reduce the amount of complicated words I use for my diesel-sniffing friends. However, this question is for all four editors. Now, I know you can't play favourites when you answer this question. And having edited my chapter in the book, John, I already forgive you if my chapter is not your answer. I kind of don't like reading my chapter now. I do read it every night, though, before I go to bed. But I would like you all, or y'all, to tell me your favourite chapter in Strategy Strikes Back. You are allowed to say your own, of course. And we're going to do this in order. So I'm going to give you the order, and we'll see if each guest remembers the order. So we'll start with Jane, followed by Matt, Max, and then John.
Being first, I don't have to try and remember my order, which really pleases me because my memory this morning is about as good as a goldfish. And I didn't actually have time to write a piece for this with the pace the edits are coming in and my own personal bandwidth. So, you know, I don't have to worry about choosing my own versus someone else. One of the pieces that I really enjoyed working on was actually Chuck B's. And part of that was because of the commentary we had going on in the comments, which I kind of wish could have come through to the final anthology. But I think what I enjoyed more than anything else was that we were able to get some non-American perspectives, because one of the issues that we run into, especially in military science fiction, is that all of the voices are American. We have so few other voices coming in. And it was very interesting to me when I was doing war stories that we were getting those other voices and we were getting those other locations and perspectives. And that was really, really powerful. And those were some of the pieces that people responded to the best. And I think that it's no surprise with that, that the War Stories actually became one of the recommended books for the U.S. Marines this year, because it did bring in some outside voices. And so I really love that we have pieces like from you, Mick, that are outside of the American perspective. Within the military, I know that the Australians and the Canadians and, you know, many, many other militaries are deeply respected, especially from guys who've served at higher levels or in more of the special areas of command. But that doesn't really get translated out into the civilian perspective, and I don't know how much it gets translated out into the general military perspective in America. And one of the things that we so desperately need right now is an understanding of people other than ourselves, both from the side of people who would very much like to pretend that we are the one and only, and from those of us who understand that we are a piece in a larger world and need to remember that we are not fighting this war for democracy on our own. So I'm kind of copping out because I can't pick a favorite, but I really do love the non-American voices that we got to lend some perspective and some outside viewpoints. And also that we were able to get a fair number of science fiction authors in there to bring another sort of outside perspective and kind of get a little more diversity of thought into the book.
All right, let's see if they remember who's up next.
It's Matt. I know I'm up next.
Yes.
And if you're asking me, you know, my favorite chapter, I really want to just say I choose the honorable way out. I choose death. But, the honest truth is that I was so surprised and interested in the response that I actually got from our forward, from General Stan McChrystal. So people know him. Obviously, he's well known. I would even say globally, not just in the United States.
Yeah.
But there's a gap between you know, someone like myself and him, you know, there's at least a couple of generations between him and I. But when he wrote back and said that he was in fact interested in contributing to the book, at first I think he was a little startled, you know, and that's not just because I ran him, you know, I ran him down at his house, you know, in his bathroom, begged him to do this. You know, it was, I sent him an email, and I think at first he kind of said, well, I don't know what I would write. But when he wrote back, he said the very first time he saw the film was right after finishing Ranger School as a lieutenant. Mm-hmm. And he went and saw the initial movie in the theater. And to me, that's part of what demonstrates the power of a film like this. It's a touch point for so many different people in so many different stations of life, and within the military at so many different ranks. And when he dropped, when he dropped the mic with his last line, the line was something, and I don't remember verbatim, but it was, you know, don't be afraid to look for lessons in unlikely places. Mm. That really represented more than just empty words on a page. That actually did represent sort of, I think, a realization that he had in the back and forth that he and I had over whether he would contribute the foreword. Mm. That he felt as though the films really, he was surprised, but did find in an unlikely place that you could learn something from Star Wars. So I if I was forced, like I said, if I'm not committing ritual suicide, then it's probably General McChrystal's.
That's a fair cop. Now let's see if number three knows who they are.
Was that me?
That's you, Max.
I would have to say my favorite chapter, the one that when I say favorite, I mean the one that I can't stop thinking about, was by Steve Leonard, who was a doctrine man. And he talks about the suicidal elitism of the Jedi.
Yeah.
And comparing it to the dangers of having an insulated professional army.
Yeah.
And it's one that I've been seeing really played out over the course of the post 9/11 wars. And as also as someone who grew up post Vietnam, which I think was the greatest cop out in the history of a Western democracy, going all the way back to Rome, which is Vietnam really did split America from its military. And instead of trying to heal the gap, we codified it. And we got rid of the draft completely. And I'm not saying a draft is a good thing, but we got rid of any means of citizens to serve their country, any means. And we've been on this path ever since, where you have this sort of this elite, specialized, proud professional force that defends America, and everybody else gets to do whatever they want. And that sounded great on paper, I'm sure, in the 70s, especially when you saw the dangers of what was happening to a broken force post-Vietnam. Mm. But now we're at a time where the military is getting smaller and smaller. No one is serving. And the military literally does not have the force to deal with a large war. And we see this now. We see the fact that our reserve and National Guard units are in the regular rotation, and we have no more backstop. What happens if we have a big war? And we just saw the example of Bo Bergdahl. And quite frankly, I think Bo Bergdahl's shame should be shared by all of us, because we've just had major wars that nobody wanted to serve, and we didn't create a culture that fostered service. And as a result, we had a man like Bo Bergdahl who never should have been let anywhere near a uniform.
Yeah.
But what are you going to do? What are you going to do when you need these people? I've watched the silent scandal of recruiters committing suicide because they simply can't fill the billets. And this is what happens. And I thought Steve Leonard talked about that with the Jedi, how you have this very small, proud professional force that simply got overwhelmed by the needs of the new war when the Sith came on. And I think that's really important for a democracy. And I'm not saying we should bring back the draft. I think that would cause more harm than good.
Yeah.
But the fact that we have completely as a society outsourced the security needs and the service needs to a very small group of sheepdogs, I think is profoundly, profoundly dangerous. And I think that we need another essay by Steve Leonard about Star Wars, where basically everybody on Coruscant is saying to the Jedi, thank you for your service.
Yes, yes, definitely. That's great. And lucky number four.
Yeah, process of elimination. Even I can figure this one out. I'm going to I don't want to disappoint your legions of fawning fans, so I'm going to give a shout out to yours, Mick, because it is a fantastic chapter that you know that assesses the strategic wisdom of destroying Alderaan. Because depending on which frame of reference you use to measure to evaluate that strategic wisdom, you know, there are some ways in which you could say, yeah, it was strategically wise. Then there are a lot of ways that you could say that it's not. And you kind of really dive into that in a way that's thorough, but also engaging and interesting. So that is definitely one worth reading. But I would also like to single out two others. I had my sort of assumptions about which ones. Once we had the roster completed, once we had working titles, and I was waiting for the drafts to come in, I kind of had an idea based on topics. Which ones I was really excited to read. And I was surprised, honestly, by some of the ones that I gave short shrift to in terms of whether or not it would kind of energize me and get me enthusiastic about reading it. I was phenomenally amazed by how much some of those kind of, you know, grabbed me by the lapels and got me like thinking about issues that like I've never found terribly interesting because I didn't have a tool like this. So that's my way of saying all of them are interesting. So it's a tie for number one. But I would like to mention two in particular because they took a unique approach. And one of those is our very own Max's, where he wrote the case for planet building on Endor. And another one by another writer, phenomenal writer named August Cole, who wrote Dispatch from Hoth, When the Blood Runs Cold. And the reason that I like those is because they took a different form. They sort of dove into the universe and kind of wrote from within the universe. It just pulls you in these really like fun ways. And so those two, I would say, definitely deserve to be, on my, my top list.
Thank you, John.
You're welcome.
As someone who got to contribute to the book, it was, incredibly humbling, to go through the book and look at the chapters. My particular favorite chapter, I think it's by Jim Golby. I don't have my book with me because I'm a terrible podcast host, but it's Jim Golby's on lack of civil military control of the Jedi. I'm humbled, but I remain extremely jealous of people like Max and August who can come at it from that perspective. They pretty much wrote a new Star Wars story in their chapters, which is quite amazing.
We did it for the money.
Yeah. Shh, you did it for the art. John, in Australia, a $50 note is yellow, so we call them pineapples, and a $20 note is red, so we call them lobsters. So thanks for mentioning my chapter. There's a few pineapples and lobsters coming your way. team, my final question is actually one that has to do with the show. And if you've listened to the show before, you'll know what it is. If you haven't listened to the show before, please hang up and go away. It's my mission on this show to define war in as many ways as possible. And in fact, some of our listeners have taken this up on social media, asking themselves the same question. I'm not sure if he's a listener, I'm just going to claim that he is, Professor Jeremy Black in the UK. He's just written an article this week called What is War, which ties in very, very closely with this question and also one of our main hashtags for promoting the show. But each guest gets to finish a sentence that ties back to Big Carl von Clausewitz's mission of understanding and studying war, which is kind of what this book was trying to do. That sentence is finishing War Is. So I'll give you another order because you guys were so successful at that one. I'm going to mix it up a bit. So we'll start with Max because he's given an answer before. Then we'll follow up with John, Matt, and then Jane last. And I ask you all to finish the sentence, War Is.
War is, in the words of my mentor and veteran, Alan Alda, war is the ultimate failure of communication.
I like it. The definition, not war. And next one.
That's me. I don't. I'm gonna avoid making you add the explicit tag to this one, and I'll just say war is hard, incredibly hard. And but to really capture how hard I believe it is, there would be one or two explicit words in there to really demonstrate it, because it is hard, and we need every tool that we've got to really be able to figure out how to do it well and effectively.
Lucky number three.
It's Matt. War is tragic, creative destruction that should only be used to destroy to create a better peace.
Wow. Spoken like someone who's had a lot of time pondering this question whilst looking at a nice, beautiful lake scene. And Jane.
I have to follow up that one. I mean, we really should just end on that one.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it?
War to me is not just about the people on the ground. It's about so much beyond that, and it's about the people back home, the supports, the enemy. It's a giant, really messy jigsaw puzzle with no box photo reference, and I'm really, really glad that a book like this actually brings out the chance to talk about that.
Wow, so that's four pretty unique, not just for the episode, but for the show, definitions of war. And, you know, much like Matt saying he won't pick a favorite, and then picking a favorite in a four-star general. I won't pick a favorite out of the definitions for you four, but Matt's was my favorite, but I won't pick one. Ladies and gents, thanks very much for coming on the show. It's been an absolute pleasure working with you on the actual project. And this was, for me, this is the first time I've actually been published in print, so where people are willing to spend money on ink for my words. So personally, I found it quite rewarding. But also, it's such an important step that, as a team of editors, you've made in bridging these discussion points from, you know, something that sits in colleges and universities and extremely popular podcasts across to something that everyday people can actually understand and relate to. So Matt, Max, John and Jane, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, Mick.
And ladies and gentlemen, you can support these four lovely people and also everyone else involved in the project by buying the book, reading the book, telling your friends about the book, not giving them the book, because we want you to get them to buy the book, preferably through the Dead Prussian store, actually. Let everyone know what you think about the book. And I know that the Australian Defence Force Library has actually bought four copies of the book. That's how much they love it. We're a small library. Now, there's also the Strategy Strikes Back website and, most importantly, the Strategy Strikes Back podcast. It's very rare you'll ever hear me give a shout-out to other podcasts on the show, and that's mainly because of market forces. But I will give a shout-out to this particular podcast, the Strategy Strikes Back, and John jumps on there and he talks through each chapter with each chapter's author. So if you're on the fence about whether or not this is the book for you, one, take it from me, it is, or two, give that podcast a listen and you'll realise pretty quickly that you can get a lot of interesting lessons out just by hearing it from the authors themselves. Now, the way you can support each of the team individually is on social media, and you know that Twitter is my domain of choice. It's mainly because my mum's not on Twitter, so I know that she's not watching what I'm getting up to on there. But you can follow other people, not my mum. You can follow John at John Amble, Max at Max Brooks Author, Matt at M.L. Kavanagh, and Jane at Jane Gates. These, well, they are all very common sense Twitter handles. That's quite amazing. And if you want to follow me, you can follow me at Mick_Cook, but the show producers will probably prefer that you follow at Dead Prussian Pod. But until next time, listeners, grab a book and crack on.
Join the conversation with us on Twitter at Dead Prussian Pod, on Facebook at The Dead Prussian Page, or on our website www.thedeadprussian.com. All show notes for this episode, as well as copyright information, can be found on the website. The Dead Prussian Podcast is written, produced and hosted by Mick Cook. It is co-produced by Amanda Levito. The music used throughout is Caught in the Beat by Broke for Free and is used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. All opinions expressed by individuals on the podcast are those of the individual and not necessarily representative of any other organisation.